Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My returning guest tonight is Brian Fagan, Emeritus Professor at the University of California, Santa Barbara, and we're continuing our conversation about his monumental book, Fishing, How the Sea Fed Civilization. Brian, welcome to the show. It's a real pleasure to talk to you again.
No, it's my pleasure, too. It's great. You're a good interviewer.
This scope of this book is just really delightful and fascinating. It literally covers the entire world. Talk to me about that. How hard was that to put together?
It was a challenging, I think is the right word. The thing that was nice is that I picked out of it a kind of sequential narrative which showed just how little fishing changed. And the broad sweep of time kind of fell into place when I realized how old fishing was. And it just became a rather nice chronological and global narrative. You can't look at a story like this just looking at, say, Western North America or Europe.
No.
You've got to be global. And that's what I did.
A couple of takeaways from that international aspect of this book is that, first of all, fish helped fuel exploration. And one of the places I want to talk about in a chapter that I just found really fascinating is about the Red Sea and then people going down the coast of Africa and over to India. And as you write it, without dried fish and jars of fresh water, that never would have happened. That was not possible for people.
It would have been very difficult, to put it mildly. Actually, you picked on one of my favorite parts of the book, because in my early life, I was an African expert or specialist and spent a lot of time on the East African coast, so I know it pretty well.
I'll tell you, I got lost in that chapter, Brian. I sort of wish that was expanded into an entire book.
There have been people who played with it. A lot of it, of course, is very complex Islamic history, and Islamic navigation is a subject in its own, you know.
Well, you know, while we're on that subject, I want to talk about, and I may mispronounce this, but the Periplus of the Erythraean Sea, I never knew about until I read your book. Can you talk about what that is?
Yeah, Periplus of the Erythraean Sea is actually, in scholarly circles, a very well-known book, because it's the first account, or it's a set of sailing directions, really, written by somebody, and we don't know who he was. We think he was a pilot from Alexandria, who put together a set of directions for people going into those areas with the monsoon winds and so on. And the book was written only a few centuries after general knowledge of the monsoon winds was disseminated. And this anonymous author was really a very important catalyst for transferring this knowledge over a wide area. He clearly had first-hand experience. We don't know who he was. We don't know what sort of boat he was in. I suspect he was a merchant. It's very succinct and short, but it has become a primer. It was translated into English about, must have been 50 years ago or so, and there have been a series of translations and detailed analyses of the ports, which of course have to be deciphered. But it is a remarkable and highly comprehensive piece of work for what it is.
And we should mention the Erythraean Sea is what we call today the Indian Ocean, right?
The Red Sea, yeah.
The Red Sea.
Mm-hmm.
Now, and the other takeaway I had is that for different cultures in different parts of the world, there always seemed to be a key fish species or maybe a suite of fish species that was the center of their culture. For instance, in early Chinese fishing, you talked about carp end up being really sort of unique in the way that the Chinese fished and actually developed fish farming for carp, which was amazing, the sources that you quoted about all the things you had to do to raise carp right in ancient China.
It sounds like an easy fish to raise, but it's not. And
well, you think of a goldfish. I mean, they're related to goldfish, and those are really...
And they were first... No one knows where they were first farmed. Probably China. They were farmed on the Danube, and they're a fish that like shallow, muddy water. But you have to do all sorts of things to make sure that the water is aerated and so on. And they really are a big, big industry. Back in the 17th century, half France was fish farms for carp.
Wow.
Because of the Catholic doctrine of fish on Friday. But it fell apart when they got cod coming in, which, of course, are much easier to preserve and so on. The Chinese, it was a staple and still is. It's huge. I've just been in China, actually. One of the things that shakes me every time I go is the huge reliance on fish, and it's almost invariably farmed fish.
Huh. Now, the Chinese farming of carp, there's a famous treatise by Fan Li, I think it is, on breeding carp. And man, he had you doing all sorts of amazing things, including introducing turtles and all sorts of other stuff, just to be able to raise this carp correctly.
He was an interesting guy. He was, I think, was a very efficient official for the best part of his career. And then he retired and then suddenly got into carp farming and made a fortune. He gave away his first fortune, if I recall. But a remarkable man with an extraordinary knowledge of the farming, which is not easy.
I want to spend the rest of the show talking about the last section of your book, The End of Plenty. And that is a very sobering section of this book, because you revealed that people started to become aware of the depletion of stocks much earlier than I thought that people would have been aware of them. There were always somebody who was saying, well, you know, the fish are being depleted. And then there was a sort of contrary voice saying, not at all. There's always going to be enough fish in the ocean. Talk about that.
This is a very fascinating and very complex issue. For a moment, I want to be specific about the book. What I did not do is get in depth into the current crisis in the oceans. There are libraries full of books on this. One of the things that's very interesting about all these climatic and biological crises we have is that all of it is modern. Very few people go back into the historical roots, so what I did was to go back into the historical roots. And if you go into that, you get immediately up against the Christian doctrine that we're masters of the ocean.
That's right.
And that basically implies that the fish resources of the ocean are unlimited. And this is a became doctrine. And people in the era when people believed in the scriptures simply believed it. Yeah. And
As you write, I mean, there are people who believe that if we didn't sort of fish the ocean as much as we possibly could, we weren't doing the work of God. We actually had to deplete. We were supposed to go out there and just take as much fish as possible.
Oh, indeed. And of course, this gets into early Christian doctrine and so on. And of course, the assumption that the resources of the ocean abound, still people believe it, which
yeah.
is nonsense.
It's interesting. It also ties in with meat-free holy days. There was a tremendous, as you write, by 1200, there was an incredible number of meat-free holy days. Now, before then, fish were not eaten by a lot of people, but as soon as you increase the number of meat-free holy days, the demand for fish starts becoming sort of overwhelming, and herring become the first focus. Now, what's specifically unique about herring as a food fish? You talk about that it's very oily,
yes,
and it has to be salted right away. It doesn't seem like it keeps very well.
It is a very tricky fish to preserve. The way it was done ultimately was to cure it in brine in barrels, at which they became real art, real experts. And these processes, which first apparently developed in the Baltic, became highly refined. And it was the first time that fish really became a commodity. And they were shipped in barrels all over Europe. The whole setup was highly organized. There were guilds, there were markets on the beach, and so on. It became the first international fish trade. It is not an attractive fish when dried. It's rather stick-like, and there are records of people saying how awful Lent was because they had to eat this fish. The big thing about preserving fish in an era where there were no trains and everything was normally transferred by horse and cart or by barge meant that you really had to have pretty well preserved fish. And this is what the barreled fish overcame, was the oiliness. But when you turn to carp, to cod, you're dealing with a very different fish. It's white fish. It's much less oily. It can be dried in the wind, which was done up on Lofoten Islands in northern Norway. And if ever you get a chance, go there. It's a fascinating, lovely part of the world. And they fish there in midwinter, and the cod fishery there became very famous. It still is. They now ship salted fish and dried fish to, of all places, Nigeria. And the fish were traded for all kinds of different reasons. One, of course, was the satisfying of the needs of the devout. I think it was 12, 15 or so, half the days in the year were holy days and technically meatless days. The demand was enormous. But, and this is the thing which people don't realize, is that cod, which is light, can be preserved easily for up to a year.
That's right.
Can be crammed together and shipped in enormous quantities for military rations. Huh. And for naval rations. And the Norse, who explored the North Atlantic, relied on it like beef jerky. It was a staple, just something that's little known. It really was a very, very major staple. And the trade continued long after the Catholic doctrines kind of receded in the face of Protestantism. But the trade in dried fish between, say, New England and Southern Europe continued right into historic times. It still goes on.
I want to get back to herring for a minute because the herring stocks collapsed. You write around that it was, I think, around 1500, where there was the Little Ice Age, and the herring stocks collapsed. Was there a connection between the Little Ice Age and the herring stocks collapsing?
One of the things that is a bit mystery is the fluctuations in herring. They, some years, and this was true in the Scania markets of the Baltic, they would have year after year boom, and suddenly they'd have years with almost no fish. And nobody really knows why this happened. It is probably connected with changing sea temperatures. And maybe a few degrees change could make a difference. And nobody really knows. It's one of the research projects that's being worked on a lot. Is clearly a complex issue, but this was not an issue that could be controlled by the fishing people. They just lived with it.
Now, were people already starting to fish cod when the herring? So was there then, when the herring stocks collapsed, was there then an immediately then push for more cod?
It was already moving, yes.
Okay.
For two reasons. One, logistically, they're much easier to handle than salt. And two, cod are offshore fish. Herring tend to be inshore fish, and they began to develop the boats like the famous Dogger of the North Sea, which could go to winter out in the open North Sea and Atlantic in midwinter and catch fish in bitter cold. And they did it, and they caught them, put them in barrels, lightly salted, and took them ashore. It is said that the casualty rate in some of these fisheries was 60%, and that percentage almost entirely was people getting wrecked on their way home. So once you go offshore, the whole ball game changed.
Well, you're right about it. I mean, how many? There was one season where I forget how many ships like did not come back. It was an incredibly dangerous enterprise to do offshore fishing.
Yeah, but life was cheap in those days. Life expectancy was no one lost, but it was 28, and they've now, of course, taken modern replicas of Norse ships out, and life on them, is even with the modern comforts, is not pleasant. They were tough cookies, and they were out in the Atlantic in hurricane-scale seas off Greenland and so on, and they survived. They were tough, consummate navigators.
You're listening to WISN.
They lived off God.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch, my returning guest tonight, and it's always a pleasure to talk to him, Brian Fagan, emeritus professor at the University of California, Santa Barbara, and historian and writer. And today we're continuing our conversation about his book. It's a really fascinating read, Fishing, How the Sea Fed Civilization. Brian, it seems as cod stocks were sort of exhausted or they were getting fewer of returns, it kept propelling European fishermen westward and eventually to Newfoundland and then down to Cape Cod. And is it safe to say, therefore, that the need for cod helped propel Europeans to North America?
Oh, yeah. It was definitely a factor in settlement. When Cabot, and there is doubt as to whether Cabot, in fact, was the first person to go there, went to Newfoundland, his men literally gathered up cod in baskets from the surface. It was so rich. And within a generation, it was becoming a major factor. This was economically a huge industry. Really, really, really huge. And something that's almost been underestimated. And there is enormous literature on cod fishing in the North Atlantic. And there's a fascinating book by a man called Geoffrey Bolster, which is called The Mortal Sea, published about 5 years ago, which is a comprehensive discussion of how the North Atlantic fisheries basically became decimated. And this is a very, very beautiful, thoughtful, and absolutely lovely piece of writing about this very complex subject. And I relied on this book somewhat superficially because it just is a superb study, a definitive study of a very complex fishery.
Well, there's this concept that you talk about in the book. I think it was from James Barrett, or Bartlett, excuse me, the fish event horizon. And talk to me about what the definition of that is.
It's very fascinating because the study of fish archaeologically, as the book points out, is extremely complex and difficult. I went to a lab in Australia, in Brisbane, where they do Pacific lagoon fish, and their laboratory of modern fish is fascinating because they have huge stocks of modern ones, and they compare the bones with the bones of ancient fish found in shell middens and so on, which of course are hard to identify because they're fragmentary. And from this has developed a huge and rapidly expanding literature on ancient fishing. And the big push has been, of course, with cod. And there are two or three remarkable scholars, archaeologists, who are working in Iceland and the North Sea area. And they discovered that there was a period in the 8th, 11th, and 12th century where suddenly cod became important, and the fish trade really, really expanded. And this has been called the cod event horizon. Archaeologists have the tendency to think of horizons and eras, but this really was a major catalyst. It was caused by a rising demand because of the need to eat fish on holy days and Fridays, by a demand for military rations, and also by slightly improved infrastructure in Europe, which was really started with the herring trade with barrels, where fish were traded up the major European rivers. And it became a rapidly expanding industry. And it's very interesting, if you look at the bones found in Icelandic sites of this era, that suddenly the cod all become of a standard size, because they're catching and keeping a certain size of fish, which they would then preserve. And you just find the heads and other parts in the middens. So it really became a standardized industry, because the big thing about modern fishery isn't the catch, it's the commodity of fish commodity.
You're right that originally I think it was Bergen that dominated the cod trade, but then later it was places in Britain like Plymouth and Dartmouth. And I love reading in your book about them just sort of going from the North Sea to Iceland and eventually to Newfoundland, and then they began leaving caretakers in Newfoundland and essentially colonizing Newfoundland with people who were from the cod industry.
I don't know if one can really call them colonists. These were camps, and Newfoundland was not an inviting place to be to live overnight. It isn't even now. It's very cold. But they left these caretakers because they wanted to keep the prime processing plants, because they would catch the fish inshore, process them on shore, salt them lightly, and then they would have mother ships that would take them over to Europe and come back. So it was a highly organized thing, and those who were there first stayed there, so people began to do that. But they didn't become, many of them, permanent colonists. One has to think almost like the migrant agricultural labor in California and other states, where people come in, do their thing, and go home. Some of these fishermen, they have records of them, would go 1 year to Greenland, 1 year to Iceland, 1 year somewhere else.
Wow.
They were migrant workers. And the people who were the caretakers were exactly the same. Permanent colonization is something that was somewhat later.
Now, eventually this leads to the birth of the New England fishery.
Yeah.
And that's about, what, mid-17th century, where cod is still the staple of the New England fishing business.
Indeed it was. And, of course, a major element in that trade was the cod trade of less good quality cod down to the sugar plantations for the slaves.
Huh.
And this was a major industry. And the major focus of much of the New England trade was with the Catholic countries of Southern Europe.
Now, what follows rapidly in your book is fascinating. There seems to be a series of technological inventions or developments that make fishing easier, able to get more catches, more fish. You start with seine nets and then beam trawls, purse seines. You go from coal and into steam. And all this is having an effect on the fish stocks. Can you address that?
The most fascinating thing, or one of the most fascinating things when writing this book, was a startling discovery, which actually my agent, the editor, originally pointed out, that technology of fishing changed remarkably little right into the 19th century.
Yeah. Yeah.
And people in the 19th century were still using hooks and lines and all the old simple traditional things. The things that transformed international fisheries were precisely the devices you were talking about. Long lining with thousands of hooks, which is still used. Bottom trawling, which in Europe became increasingly ruthless, and there were complaints, and commissions said, it doesn't matter, there's plenty of fish there, they'll recover, which they didn't, because they disturbed the seabed. You got the same thing happening in the North Atlantic, and at first the catch rose and then it fell. And today's problems with cod fisheries and elsewhere are due to absolutely ruthless exploitation, much of it in the 19th and early 20th centuries, before people really became aware of the difficulties of maintaining sustainable fisheries. And huge advances have been made in fostering sustainable fisheries, but we've hardly begun. The other thing which really changed it was the Industrial Revolution, the reduction of fossil fuels, diesels, steamships originally, then gasoline, then diesel, and now you've got refrigeration ships at sea, processing fish and freezing them out in the ocean. And the whole thing just has escalated. But the silent elephant in all this historical room is very simple. It's growing population.
Right.
And if you go to China and you see the enormous urban development, the high-rise buildings and so on, a great deal of this creates, with its massive demand for fish, a huge unsustainable industry, which one of the solutions to is, of course, to farm fish. And there are now figures which suggest that as many as half the fish eaten in Asia are farmed, and a large number that we eat are farmed. And there were ecological problems with that. And the question is, what's going to happen in the future? And that's where I stop, because I am just simply not qualified to really talk about it. One of the big arguments, of course, is for the creation of fish reserves. But then you get into all the issues with will people obey the rules hundreds of miles from the shore and so on. And you've only got to go, and I really recommend this if you go there, go to the Tokyo Fish Market where they have these tuna auctions. When I was there, you could walk as they were doing it. Now it's been kind of sanitized for tourists. But this is really sobering, because you see rows and rows of tuna carcasses sold for huge prices. And you look at them and you say, how many fish are left in the ocean?
Wow.
And the answer is that the tuna fishery in the long run probably isn't necessarily doomed, but is going to be a fraction of what it is now.
On that note, unfortunately, we have to say goodbye. We are completely out of time. My returning guest tonight is Brian Fagan, Emeritus Professor at the University of California, Santa Barbara, talking about this is an important book, but it's also, I want to mention, it's a fun book to read. There's a lot of stuff I just got lost in learning about. Fishing, How the Sea Fed Civilization. Brian, it's always a pleasure to talk to you.
It's funny. It was funny, though, because some of the reviewers are saying the book is too academic.
Are you serious? they didn't read the book. And I often,
well, no, not only that, but I'm labeled as a professor, which, of course, is perfectly true.
Well, anyhow, if this is an academic book, it's more fun than most academic books I've read. So there.
Well, I love the cover. They did a beautiful job.
They did.
Yeah.
So, Brian, anyhow, good. We have to say goodbye.
Good.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.